try and think about what the democracy means in terms of United States culture. So a couple of dates. We've already talked about when individualism plays out, that is the word itself, a concept. So in 1827, it's a pretty important date for us, we see for the first time individualism appear as a word. But the other thing that we see in 1827, very importantly, is the word Democrat becoming mainstream. So remember when we had talked about this before, democracy was always synonymous with passions and with animal instincts. So it wasn't one of those things that was lauded. It was seen as something that was inhibiting or at least brought out the worst of us. But in 1827, we have, for the first time, our first political party that ever existed in United States history, not a political movement, but an actual political party founded in 1827. And they take the name, of course, of the Democratic Party. This party is, from the beginning, a very strange, and it's the same institutional party we have, institutionally in terms of history, the same party as the Democratic Party today. But when it's founded, its institutional basis is a bringing together of a number of different interests. So if we, which I think especially at Hillsdale we like to do, if we like to think that a party represents a certain set of ideas, we're going to miss everything, because that's not what the Democratic Party was about. There were people within the Democratic Party that advocated imperialism, others that would have been, you know, only what we need to do at home. There would have been some who would have believed in very high tariffs, others who didn't believe in tariffs at all. Some would be pro-slavery, others would be anti-slavery. So there's no way that you can put an overall feeling or set of ideas on the original Democratic Party. Instead, what it is, from the very beginning, is a meeting of interests. That is, a number of people that want to come together and try and help one another to get political things done. So I wouldn't call that necessarily good. They are looking for a greater good rather than a common good. So Washington, and you guys saw this when you read through Washington, there's no such thing as being able to have political parties in a republic. The moment you have political parties in a republic, your republic's probably done. So for the first 51 years after the Declaration, we have no parties, and that's very intentional. But when they're founded in 1827, they stand for three things, and these will be based on three personalities and the things that they each stand for. So probably the greatest author of the Democratic Party, and the most important, is John C. Calhoun, who represents the South. Then we have Martin Van Buren, who represents New York. And the final person representing the frontier is Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. And so the idea behind the Democratic Party, and they do some really nasty stuff to get it going right at the beginning. Their figurehead, of course, will be Andrew Jackson. They think that Jackson's a buffoon, but they're quite wrong. He's brilliant. Kind of an evil brilliance, but still brilliant. And so what happens in this foundation is you have the idea that if you can pull together a number of disparate interests for some kind of common goal, everybody within those interests will benefit. They're not concerned from the very beginning. Political parties are never concerned with the country as a whole. They really can't be. It's impossible. They may proclaim it. So when the Whig Party is founded in 1833, they will proclaim they're for the common good rather than the greater good. But once you have parties, it's very difficult to actually represent the whole country. They'll try. And certainly the Whigs tried. The Republicans have tried from time to time. Democrats, through people like Grover Cleveland, and even later with John F. Kennedy. But for the most part, it's not an aspect of parties to look for the common good. So what happens is you have this movement. It's all proposed by John C. Calhoun. And Calhoun says, this is how we can create our first political party. We need to have the Southern plantation owners as a part of this. And they control the South. And especially, you know, depending on where you are in the South, if you're in South Carolina, they control everything. If you're in Mississippi, they control a lot. But regardless, they're the most powerful figures. So you don't need the vote of women. You don't need blacks, obviously. You just need to get the votes of those who matter. And in the South, that would be the plantation owners, because they control everything. So if we can have that, you've got this whole block of Southern senators, you have a whole block of the South, and that means that if you're going to do this, you've got to support slavery. It's going to be the one thing they have in common. They're going to want to be able to sell their cotton abroad. They're going to want to be able to produce it, to grow it. So you have to have this interest. But you also need a popular vote. And you're not going to get that in the South because there aren't enough popular voters in the South to matter. So if you're going to get a popular vote outside of the South, where do you do it? You do it by getting Western farmers on your side. Now, this is never going to work perfectly. This is all theory. But that's the reason Thomas Hart Benton is brought into this mix. His goal is to get free farmers in the West on the frontier where America's growing to try and get them to be on the side of the Democratic Party and to vote Democratic. About the only thing that they have in common generally with the South, you know, most farmers don't really care one way or the other about slavery because they're not going to be able to afford slaves. Most poor whites can't. And of course, it's not legal in most aspects of the West, so it's not something they're even thinking about. And slavery doesn't work in non-humid areas. That's something we could talk about at another time, but it just doesn't work. So the only thing that they're going to have in common with the Southern slave owners is they believe in free trade. So farmers typically, and that's still true today, if you look at the Kansas Farm Bureau or Nebraska Farm Bureau, at one of their main platforms, they always want free trade. It's one of the great problems of the EU, too, because places like Denmark are constantly in favor of free trade. Other countries are not. But farmers are almost always in favor of free trade, not for necessarily philosophical reasons, but for very practical reasons. They need markets open. But then you also have to have money. So you've got the Southerners and you have Western farmers. If you need money, this is where Martin Van Buren comes in. He will represent Wall Street, what we will call Wall Street. It's not Wall Street yet. I mean, there is a Wall Street, but it's not what we think of yet. And so that will be the money interest. So this, from the very beginning, and I hope this is clear for everybody, this is a major dramatic change from the founding. So 51 years after the Declaration, you have the formation of a party. This is radical. And that's why I've stressed to you, when you're looking at Tendell Shee, and they go back and they list the parties of the first presidents, I think they have something like, is Washington other? And then they have Jefferson as the first Democratic Republican. That is complete bunk. There was no such thing as a Democratic Republican at that period. There was no party like that. It is purely a thing that historians like to do for convenience to go back. So everybody in the first 50 years would have regarded themselves as a Republican, small r. They might have been more Federalist-leaning or less Federalist-leaning, but they certainly would not have called themselves a Democrat. In 1801, to have called someone a Democrat, I would have ended in a duel. But that's amazing that only a few years later, it becomes such a popular word, you can make a party based on it. So that's something that we have to consider. Why is that happening? So in response to this, and again, don't try and put too many ideas behind this, because aside from generally believing in free trade, there's not a lot that the Democrats have in common, which is why Andrew Jackson has to find a scapegoat immediately and why the Indians become the scapegoat. Everybody can agree that we can kind of abuse them. So they become the common scapegoat in all of this. And Jackson is clearly in favor of doing whatever he can for power. And that can become clear here. In opposition, in 1833, Calhoun, who founded the Democratic Party, realizes this monster got out of control, and I'll explain why here in a moment. He and Webster and Clay formed the first opposition party, which we call the Whig Party. And the only reason that they take the name Whig, they're taking this from the English tradition, but the reason they take the name Whig is because Whig meant not having a powerful executive. So Whig just simply meant we don't want a powerful presidency. So all of this matters because when Andrew Jackson comes into power and he's picked by Van Buren and Thomas Hart Benton and Calhoun because they think they can manipulate him, which is the last thing they're going to be able to do. But when they pick him, he comes in and he recognizes the only way to really transcend those three is if he takes all of the political power within the executive office. And so our very first strong executive, the kind of executive that we saw over the last, 16 years, and now, we'll see what happens with Trump, but the kind of strong executive we've seen all comes out of Andrew Jackson. So prior to that, you don't have a strong executive. You may have a powerful or charismatic one like George Washington, but they're not strong in terms of wielding immense power. Remember, Washington doesn't even have an army under him. There is no U.S. Army under Washington. The few times that we have to go to war against the Indians, he has to raise privately his own army, the American Legion, which is used to fight against Indians in this region. But it's not the U.S. Army in the way we think of. We had a Navy and Marines, but we didn't have a standing army in any way. And that, because that was back when they believed you're only commander-in-chief if Congress declares war. So it's not all the time. It's only part of the time. So Andrew Jackson is the very first president we'll have who actually argues that he is the embodiment of the American people, as opposed to Congress being the embodiment of the American people. So that's why the Whigs, when they're founded, they're arguing directly against the idea that you can centralize power, and especially democratic power, in the executive. So even the most ardent person in favor of a strong executive during the founding, Alexander Hamilton, would have worried about this, because his argument was, even Hamilton's, who wanted the strongest presidency of any of the founders, his argument was, this is the fetus of monarchy. That was the language they used. So if the Constitution would ever go wrong, it would go wrong through the presidency, and it would go wrong by the president proclaiming himself to be the embodiment of the American people. So this has nothing to do, and I hope this is clear for everyone, this has nothing to do with left, right, Republican, Democrat. Every one of our presidents, especially in the 20th century, into the 21st century, every single president runs on the idea that he or she best embodies the American people. But that is completely anathema. Even Reagan, my favorite president of the 20th century, did this. And that is not part of the founding at all. That is a direct attack on the ideals of the founding. The executive is to do one thing. The executive executes the will of the people as represented in Congress. That, I hope, is clear from what we studied in the Constitution. So this is the first time. And Jackson opens a door that, once it's opened, it's very difficult to shut. Because he even says, I am the democratic will. So he's talking in very Rousseauian language, and he's speaking much more like a French revolutionary, even though he's not, he's a conservative. But he's speaking like a French revolutionary when it comes to political power. So as anyone, this is always interesting to me. What do you guys know about Andrew Jackson? What's being taught in high schools? Is he good? Is he bad? And when I was a kid, he was a great figure, except there were a number of mostly new leftists and hippies who started hating him because of his Indian policy. I'm curious how he's being taught. Anybody at all? Jared?
The Trail of Tears.
Okay, so that's what most of them. So usually, and you guys are, I assume you're laughing because that's how you're all being taught. And that's true, of course. I mean, we can't deny that. It was absolutely brutal, as we talked about. Roughly 2 out of every 3 Southern Indians was killed en route, so within about a year, all because of U.S. government interference with them and removal. It's a terrible, absolutely heinous crime, without any question about that. But usually it's taught, at least when I was a kid, it was taught that, well, that's too bad he did that, but there are all these good things he did because he gave us a strong presidency. And so that, and part of this, there's a historiography behind it. We won't have to get into this for probably until after your second midterm. But this is, there was a revival of Jackson in the 1930s because a lot of people were trying in the Democratic Party, people like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., were trying to make an argument that it's okay to have a strong executive. And so they turned back to, well, the first great strong executive was the first president of the Democratic Party. FDR is just the same guy 100 years later. So that was my growing up in the late 70s and 80s. That's what we were taught. But Jackson, I think very importantly, is critical for us because he does wield this immense executive power. So anybody else know how did he rise to popularity? And this is, I think, for Aaron.
Yeah, didn't he, what I learned in school was that he was pretty much self-made. So
yeah.
He started off as like the bottom of the
barrel.
Like, yeah. And he kind of like wiled his way into, I think he started in the military, I think it was.
Maybe. Yeah, and what is he ethnically? Anybody know Jackson? So all the other founders, Washington, Adams, Madison, Monroe, right? All of Quincy Adams, they're all non-Scotch-Irish, right? Jackson's Scotch-Irish. He's the first Scottish president we have. Interesting. We have one now, too, right? But that, I think that's very important. So he comes from a very lower-class family. His dad is killed when he's very young. He actually was a boy during the American Revolution, and he remembers very, very vividly a British soldier stepping on his head and cracking his skull right here and held him down when he was a young boy. He never got over that, by the way. Jackson is a really interesting figure. He took for the rest of his life, and don't ever do this. Right? There are very few things Jackson does that you want to imitate, but this is definitely one of them. He used to take a teaspoon of lead every morning because he thought this was good for his brain. So, yeah, that do not, I heard, I'm sure you guys, you know, do not eat lead. Right? It is very, very bad for you. But and he used to rub lead in his wounds. He was a strong believer that lead solved all problems. It did not. But that's part of it. He just had constant pain. He had, and he's brilliant, but he had constant pain because of that injury when he was a kid, and he never forgave the British for this at all. Chloe.
Oh, I don't know if the story is true or not, but I always heard that he he was able to read at a young age, and so he read the Declaration aloud when it was first written. I was not sure if that was one of the
I don't know. That's a great kind of mythic story.
Like, okay, this is who
it could be true. He was really smart, and he definitely was hardcore pro-America, and he would have been very pro-Declaration. He interprets it in an odd way, I think. But yeah, that's... So there's one other... So thank you for that. There's one other thing, though, he's remembered for. How did he make his reputation? Katerina.
Yeah, there was one particular battle. I think... Was it... not the Spanish... Was it the Spanish American?
No. It was the War of 1812.
Oh, damn.
He was involved in with that, Florida too.
Yeah, it was like in Mississippi or something.
Yeah, New Orleans. Yeah, no, that's okay. That's okay.
Santiago,
no, that's great, Marina.
Didn't he also? Well, this was after the War of 1812 and Battle of New Orleans, and the Battle of New Orleans occurred after the war was technically over. Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Yep.
But then,
but only by about a month. We didn't know.
Yeah, but then in Florida, there was something weird. It was like Congress had told him, okay, guard the border into Florida, and he took that, and gave him permission to, like, chase fugitive Native Americans
into
Florida, and he took that as an invitation to take Florida.
Yeah, and then he was given it. He became the first governor of Florida.
And he goes back to Congress and says something along the lines of, well, you never said I couldn't.
No, that's right. That's very good. Yeah.
I always knew him as Old Hickory, the man who was had an attempted assassination, and both of the pistols misfired, and then he almost beat the assassin to death.
Just very Jackson. Yeah, yeah. No, these are great. Okay, so let me give you just a little bit of background here. So Jackson's very intelligent, and he makes all of his power by becoming the head of the Tennessee Freemasons. So he uses this as a way, he creates his own private army. And that's not atypical, right? Washington had private armies, we had militias. Yeah, this, it may sound really strange to us, but it was pretty normal in this Republican period that you would raise your own army as kind of a militia, kind of something greater. So he raised his own army through the Tennessee Freemasons. And he was brilliant in the sense that he had observed where the British were attacking us in the War of 1812. So he recognized that the two major assaults on America had all been water-based. So the first major assault was to go down the St. Lawrence River and to attack this area. There were actually battles here in Hillsdale during the War of 1812 and all the way to Monroe and Marshall, this whole area into Canada. But then the second attack, of course, was on Baltimore and Washington and going up the Chesapeake. So Andrew Jackson very logically reasoned that if there were to be a third attack, it would come up the Mississippi. So he raised a little over 2,000 men. And he's very anti-Indian in the broad, but he adopted an Indian child. He fought all the time with Indians. So he's just not principled in the sense that we could say, oh, either hated Indians or loved them. He was, if he could use them politically, he did. If he could use them in his army, he would as well. So he made this army. He even had some pirates from the Caribbean that were fighting with him, some French pirates. And what he did, the first real attempt at modern warfare, he and his men got down to New Orleans, and they dug immense trenches all at the mouth of the Mississippi River so that if the British Navy decided to attack, they would have to do so by going next to these trenches. And the guy who was chosen is really not a smart guy, but a very interesting guy. The guy who was chosen to lead the invasion was a man who had done one very brave thing against Napoleon. And so he was, as a gift for having rushed his troops into battle, he was given the gift of the final invasion of the United States, this guy named Ned Pakenham. And so he very, very stupidly, this is where you see the aristocratic military, this does not work. When you put someone in charge of the military simply because they have a noble title, and he's a lord. And so he launches this attack against Jackson, and he has close to 10 times the number of men that Jackson does. And yet Jackson only loses about 20 of his men in this assault, and he's able to kill roughly 2,000 British soldiers as they're wading into the Gulf and trying to attack him. Almost 400 of the bodies were so decimated on the part of the British that they couldn't even find body parts. They just washed out into the Gulf. And Pakenham himself was killed during this invasion. And this is Jackson. Jackson took his body, carved it up, actually took off all his limbs, head, everything, packed it into a barrel, pickled it with vinegar, and then sent the body back to the man's wife. That's Jackson. Right, this guy's just incredible. But he's a hero afterwards. And one of the weirdest things that comes out of all of this is that the British actually respect us immensely, because everything up to that point had been kind of a stalemate. We had, you know, the treaty that was signed was status quo ante bellum, meaning everything was as was. And then we have this last battle. We handily defeat the greatest empire in the world after they had just defeated Napoleon. And the strangest thing is, our entire friendship with Britain dates to that victory, because suddenly they realize we're a power and they can't just mess with us when they want. And they had thought up to that point we would collapse at any moment. So this is why I want you to realize Jackson's a weirdo, but he's a very important one for us in all kinds of ways, not only for assertion of national power abroad, whether we think that's good or not, but also for creating the executive, which I personally think is terrible, but that's where it comes from. So here, and to get into Marina and some of the other points you guys were making. So after his success with his private army there, he's barely recognized by the U.S. military. He chases the Seminoles into Florida in 1818. He executes two British diplomats he finds down there, which he's not supposed to do. And he just thinks that, you know, he's getting away with a lot. So then, you guys don't have to write all this down, but I just want you to know this as background. So not only is he chasing these people into Florida, but now the administration under James Monroe has to decide what to do with this guy. They've got a very popular war hero with a major army, the largest army on American soil, not under American command, but just kind of privatized, and he's running around in Florida executing British officials and driving the Indians into the swamps and angering the Spanish as well. So what do we do with him? So there's a huge debate in the administration. The Secretary of State under James Monroe is none other than John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams is the best Secretary of State we have ever had. We've never had a better one. He is the best. He's one of our worst presidents. Great guy. Just terrible president. But he's a fantastic Secretary of State. If he's the guy behind the power, he's really good. If he's the power, he's just not effective at it. But he's the guy behind the power. And he tells Monroe, look, Jackson may be crazy, but all of this is working to our benefit. Every time I go in to negotiate with the British or Spanish, all I have to do is drop his name, and I can get anything I want. And so he tells Monroe, you need to back him. But his Secretary of Defense is John C. Calhoun. And John C. Calhoun says, this guy's out of control. And in writing, he says, we need to create an American force to go down, arrest, and execute Andrew Jackson. He has that in writing. Well, Monroe goes with John Quincy Adams and says, no, we're not going to execute him. In fact, we're going to recognize his victory. And then after that, I'm going to make him territorial governor. And that was to calm him down, because what he wanted to do, he sent a note to Monroe saying, now that I've conquered Florida, I'm moving to Cuba. Oh. And Monroe said, I think you should stop. And you should stop by me making you territorial governor. So it was a compromise. You make him territorial governor to give him some power. So very first thing Andrew Jackson does as territorial governor, every white male is given the vote. Very telling. Every white male, nobody else, but every white male, regardless of rank, If you are a white male in Florida, you're now a citizen. So that tells us a lot about what he's going to do. Well, here's one of my favorite moments in history. So it's April of 1830 now. Jump forward a little bit. Who's president? Andrew Jackson. Who's his vice president?
John C. Calhoun.
John C. Calhoun. Andrew Jackson asks for the papers about him when he was territorial governor of Florida. And he comes across a letter in which his vice president suggested he be executed. Calhoun has to resign. He goes back and becomes senator, which tells you how malleable everything is. But anyway, I want you all to know that. So this is all very important. So what else happens? Well, one of the things that Calhoun tries to do, and this is, to me, this is just fascinating, and it's pure political craziness. One of the things Calhoun tries to do when he forms the Democratic Party in 1827 is they have to have a reason for all the Democrats to come together. What's going to hold them together? It's not enough just to have these three interests. Something has to hold them together. So Calhoun, who he is, I'd say probably after Jefferson, and I don't mean this as a compliment necessarily, it's just a fact. I'm not sure anyone has ever been born on our soil that's smarter than Calhoun, except for Jefferson. I mean, the guy's brilliant when it comes to theory, what he studied, everything. I don't think he's a good guy, but I think he's brilliant. And what he does is he anonymously writes a huge tariff bill. Now just think about that. John C. Calhoun, probably the most ardent free trader in America, writes an immense tariff bill. And he has one of his allies introduce it into Congress in 1827. His whole ploy here, and this, if this doesn't tell you what political parties are like, nothing will. His whole ploy is to get this thing to be so absurd that he can draw out all of the people who are really pro-high tariff from all of those who are free traders. And his assumption is, we'll have a bill that's so crazy that only the wackos will be in favor of it. And we'll be able to say, look at these guys, they're our scapegoats now. We're going to form the Democratic Party against those guys who are obviously crazy. But when this bill gets introduced into Congress, it's introduced as, this is de facto going to be passed. So it doesn't matter if you're free trade or not. If you want your section of the country to be protected, you better get a rider to put on this bill to make sure that whatever industry is in your area is protected. So rather than this thing becoming a joke, which everyone laughs at, it takes on a life of its own. So everybody takes a piece of this thing. It's really the first time the federal government has ever been used to distribute money and wealth, and it's passed. It's passed in 1828. It's the highest tariff bill we've ever had. What's Calhoun do? Of course, he has to resign as vice president 2 years later, but when he goes back to South Carolina, he writes, and you guys haven't read this yet, but we will, he writes his nullification and protest against the same bill that he had written. This is politics, right? It's just crazy to think about all this. But so whenever I hear Democrats, and Republicans aren't that much better, but whenever I hear Democrats talking about the nobility of their party, you just have to laugh. I mean, are you crazy? This thing is formed in complete absolute selfishness and insanity. So we're going to turn to a couple of other things, but I had asked you guys to read for today to look at some of these writings that we have coming up here right after Democracy in America, to look at these writings we have on the Alamo and on the great nature of Nation of Fortuity. So let's turn to that. And we're going to start with the great Nation of Fortuity. So this is on page 339. So, in addition, do you guys want to move up, or someone, Aaron, would you mind sitting with them so they can look at the document? So, the two other issues that become important, so we have individualism and the Democratic Party arising, and all this political, these machinations, and the tariff. But the two other things that we're going to see that are critically important for our time period here as we lead up to the American Civil War. So obviously slavery is an issue, but we'll come back to that in a bit. So the two other issues that really matter are, number one, what is the West? That is, how does the West of America, the American frontier, how does it define what it means to be an American as a critical issue for us? The second question that's related to this, and especially as we're thinking about what we read in de Tocqueville and we're seeing all of these things, is where does sovereignty reside? So if we say it's we the people, does that mean that it's through Congress or the president or just individual action? So this becomes the great question. Where is sovereignty? Where is we the people? So one of the ideas that arises during the Jacksonian period, though interestingly enough, Jackson doesn't quite buy into it, which is really weird, and that I guess we could talk about, but it's strange. But under the Democratic Party, one thing that the Democrats begin to believe in is very quick expansion into the West. And the architect of this, so this is where it gets a little complicated. Americans have always, we've had a frontier from day one. So our frontier, of course, Plymouth Rock, frontier doesn't close officially until 1919. That's the last time a homestead is taken up in Montana in 1919. People will look at the census of 1890 where they no longer see a clear frontier line, and they'll declare the frontier is closed. But homesteading doesn't end until 1919. And even then, I'm sure some of you know, in Alaska, obviously homesteading continues. Even in places like Kansas, they've reintroduced homesteading in the last few years to let smaller towns kind of grow. And my mom took advantage of that. She moved from East Kansas to West Kansas because she was given free land in West Kansas, and they were able to build their house on it tax-free, which is really smart. I mean, it's a very smart thing for states to do. But regardless, when we're talking here, we're really talking 1620 up until about 1919 for the frontier. So we've always had this. But the argument when we were a republic was that the frontier can only be settled by private initiative. So if Shelby and her family, and this one thing you have to recognize, there are very few gender restrictions on frontier settlement. It's one of the most interesting things about our frontier. There's a reason that the West is the first to give women the right to vote. And it's because you absolutely cannot break land in Indiana or Montana or California without two people doing it, meaning it's got to be husband and wife. So there's a de facto, very serious equality among women in the West, and any of you have read the Laura Ingalls Wilder, I'm sure you have, you see that characteristic. The individualism is just as important for the women as it is for the men. In some cases, it's more so, but that's another topic. So the argument was, Shelby wants to go out West, let her. But she's on her own, she and her family. So they go out West and they settle in Kentucky, it's great, but she has to break the soil, she has to clear the trees, she has to negotiate with the Indians in that area or kill them. And there's nothing we're going to do about it because that's her choice. So the frontier up until Andrew Jackson was always this thing that happened naturally. And it could be very violent. There's no question about that. But it was a violence that you chose as you went out. And how you dealt with the natives was your problem. So that was always the question. What Andrew Jackson does by introducing the removal of the American Indians is he hastens the process, basically saying at this point, now the government kind of has a role in dealing with the Indians and with settlers. And the role is not necessarily to be proactive for the settler, but to move the Indian out of the way. So that's the first kind of movement we have against the old Republican notion that was, you just take your chance and good luck. So, good or bad, you have to make your own way. Jackson doesn't take it the next step, however, but the Democrats will. The next step is, not only do we stop the Indians from harming settlers, but we now proactively help the settlers settle. And it's a fine line, obviously, but what this will be called is manifest destiny. And that is not the same thing as what Jefferson or Washington or Adams or Quincy Adams believed. So manifest destiny is a taking of this Republican idea and really militarizing it more than anything else. So whereas Shelby was going out as a private citizen, now she'll be going out under manifest destiny as an agent of America. And therefore, we have to pool all of our resources to help her. It's not that clear cut, but that becomes the idea behind manifest destiny. So there's a huge difference, and I hope this is clear for everyone. There's a huge difference between a Republican settlement of land and a manifest destiny settlement of land. We're now moving into a much more imperial way of thinking through manifest destiny. And I want you to even think about the term manifest destiny. Just think about the craziness of that. God has determined this is what we do. The fate is already willed by a greater power. America becomes not as individuals like Shelby, but America becomes the agent of God's will in taking over this land. So the clearest expression of this is from the greatest thinker among the Democrats, at least in terms of policy, a guy named John L. O'Sullivan, who is an Irish immigrant, obviously from his name, and he is very, very taken with the idea of America not just piecemeal settling the West, but actually as a concerted political power and body settling the West. So let's just open up. This is page 341. Actually, let's bottom at 340. And I hope you guys realize that as we read this, if we took this seriously, you are wiping out the entire Western Heritage course you ever took. All right, so he's arguing very clearly that America is so radically new that there is nothing we can learn from the past at all. That's it. Everything is new. So Shelby's no longer just Shelby. She is now an agent of the United States settling in the West, which means she's God's right hand. Okay, is that, everybody kind of get that? All right, so Katerina, would you mind reading?
Yeah.
You want to start just right there at the bottom. Actually, start with what friend of human liberty? See that line 30?
Yeah.
Thank you.
America is destined for better deeds. It is our unparalleled glory that we have no reminiscences of battlefields, but in defense of humanity, of the oppressed of all nations, of the rights of conscience, of the rights of personal enfranchisement. Our annals describe no scenes of horror and carnage, where men were led on by hundreds of thousands to slay one another, dupes and victims to emperors, kings and nobles, demons in the human form called heroes. We have had patriots to defend our homes, our liberties, but no aspirants to crowns or thrones. Nor have the American people ever suffered themselves to be led on by wicked ambitions to depopulate the land, to spread desolation far and wide, that a human being might be placed on the seat of supremacy. We have no interest in the scenes of antiquity, only in lessons of avoidance of nearly all their examples. The expansive future is our arena, and for our history, we are entering on its we are entering on its untrodden space with the truth of God in our minds, beneficent objects in our hearts, and with a clear conscience unsullied by the past. We are the nation of human progress, and who will, what can, set limits to our onward march. Providence is within us, and no earthly power can. We point to the everlasting truth of the first page of our national declaration, and we proclaim to the millions of other lands that the gates of hell, the powers of aristocracy and monarchy, shall not prevail against.
Okay, let's stop there for a moment. You did a great job reading this, Katerina. Thanks. I know you apologized right in the middle, but you're totally fine. This is great. So let's talk about this for a moment. What's his intent here? What's he saying? Clearly he's erasing the past. So there goes your Western Heritage course, which maybe, you know, you'd be happy with, but it's gone, right? Aaron.
He's trying to justify any heinous acts or horrid acts as an act of patriotism as opposed to those heinous acts that were mentioned.
Okay.
So he talks about the, he says, we don't have heroes that are demons in human form, but we have patriots, people who are fighting against monarchy and tyranny, as opposed to people who are committing bad acts.
Okay.
So like someone like Andrew Jackson, for example, would be a patriot more than would be a hero, or someone that would, even though you slayed all these Indians, that would be seen as something that's justified within the narrative of America being the Asian God.
Yeah. No, that's very good. Okay, so antiquity's done. We're now these agents of God in some way. What's the very language that he uses? Yeah, Shiloh.
Well, it seems like he's just tapping into the vein of religious energy that the country is aligned on, but then saying, but we're doing away with the past. So he's relying on the past energy that we've always had to promote this new idea that's
okay.
Not grounded.
And what about the language? I mean, who, he says the gates of hell shall not prevail. Who was that said to? Who's it? Yeah, it was said to Peter, right? This is Jesus' words to Peter. He didn't say America. He said the church. So that's a really interesting thing. America has become the medieval church in its own way. Right? It has become, so the gates of hell will not prevail. It shall not prevail against it. That's amazing to make that assertion. So America has become, we're the new chosen people. We're not just Israel. We're Israel and the church put together and something new in some new way. Well, if I can say that, well, what does it matter if some red man is in front of me? What is he? Yeah, what do we consider him? He's just a block, right? He's just a guy to be kicked out of the way. So there's no sense of any kind of real humanity here. Yeah, please.
He seems very French Revolutionary in that we are all that matters. It's just us, the people. The past is irrelevant at this point. It doesn't matter. It's essentially a mistake. And we're able to start anew. And we can just, it's our ability, our right to just forsake everything.
Do you think, I think you're absolutely right. Do you think O'Sullivan would see it that way? Okay, yeah, he doesn't see that. And who does he sound like? Who we've read recently. Think about the language he uses here. It's almost identical. This is just like Tao. This is second grade awakening language. And this is just like Lorenzo Tao, almost word for word, though I doubt if he's read Tao. Sullivan's actually a Catholic. This is really weird when you think about the kind of language he's trying to use here. He's an Irish Catholic. And there are things, like where he says, demons in the form of heroes, that's a line out of Augustine, out of City of God. But that's not how Augustine meant it. It's just, he's basically saying heroism is now the martyrs, not those who assert their will, but those who give up their will. So he's using language that would be very familiar and very comfortable to people, but he's using it in a fundamentally different manner. Nicole.
It's just interesting that he says it's our unparalleled glory that we know.
Yeah, this is only 7 years after what de Tocqueville described. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, well, I'm just wondering, like, were there people kind of calling out America on this, or was it just a big national blind spot?
No, it was a national blind spot, but you have a large minority of people who are very upset about it. But it is definitely the trajectory. There are a lot of people who are on the side of the Indians, a lot of Americans. We'll see that later on. I won't get into this now, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into it later, but there's one tribe in particular that had always, from the moment we met them, had been our allies in everything. We met them through Lewis and Clark. They were the tribe in Idaho called the Nez Perce. And for the Pawnee were close in being great allies, but there was no tribe better than the Nez Perce. And when we turned on them in 1877, they'd been our allies. We invaded them. They left on a trek where they went 1,200 miles with their people trying to get to Canada so we wouldn't kill them, even though they had been our best friends in every way. But during that whole trail where they're moving, you have all kinds of American citizens who are giving them aid and helping them. And that, I only bring that up because there's always this tension in America. And it's never a clear-cut thing when this is happening. So, yeah, it's a crazy story. Maybe the whole thing altogether is crazy, but yeah, he knows what's going on. But he's whitewashing it because it's justified. Remember what de Tocqueville said. No people has ever been more destroyed with a better name for liberty than the American Indians. Right? It's all been done in the name of liberty. It's all been done in the name of humanity, and yet we've wiped them out. And that's part of, so there's a lot of tension about this, abroad and home. That's a great question. Okay, so Katerina, would you mind reading the next paragraph? Because this is the key here.
The far-reached state, the boundless future, will be the era of American greatness. It is magnificent. In its magnificent domain, the space and time, the nation of many nations is destined to manifest to mankind the excellence of divine principles, to establish on earth the noblest temple ever dedicated to the worship of the Most High, the sacred and the true. Its floor shall be a hemisphere, its roof the firmament of the star-studded heavens, and its congregation a union of many republics, comprising hundreds of happy millions, calling and owning no man-master, but governed by God's natural moral law of equality,
the law of brotherhood, of peace and goodwill among us.
Okay. All right. So it's one thing to believe God has blessed you. That's good. But if God has made you the agent for world change, that might be a little egotistical, right? And yet that's exactly what he said. What's the church? The church is North America, right? It's the United States of America. And once you have that kind of manifest destiny, it's very hard to turn back. So it's an easy slide into imperialism very quickly to move from this. And again, there is opposition. And we'll talk about this. I don't know if we'll have time today because we've only got 3 minutes left. But there is an important opposition. I'll at least bring it up. Alex.
I personally just think it's amazing how so soon after the revolution, we're already pivoting away from the founding principles, yet this spirit is still very much alive.
Yeah.
To modern United
States. Yeah, and that's, I mean, can you imagine if you said this to George Washington? Think about what he said in his farewell address. It's like word for word an attack on what he said. So this is a radically different thing. You know, for Washington, being blessed was humbling. Like, oh, I've got the duty to do God's will. Oh, geez, why me? Right? And now it's like, yeah, I've got the duty to God's will. Let's blow everybody up. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but it is a difference. So let me just end with this today. And thank you, guys. This is a great class. But let me end with this as we go away from the weekend. So just to get to Nicole's question, there is opposition. There's very serious opposition. And yesterday is the great anniversary of one of the most important oppositions to this. And yet they seem related. And we have them right next to each other in your reader. We have the letter from the Alamo. And we have the Great Nation of Fortuity. Well, if you notice, if you had a chance to read William Barrett Travis's letter, he's completely humbled. And by the way, he has roughly the equivalent of his BA in the liberal arts. This is not some fool. This is a guy who was deeply educated, one of the three great fighters at the Alamo. And when they get there, and I hope, has anyone in here been to the Alamo? They have all the names carved. All right, I want you to think about this for a moment. Think how different this is from O'Sullivan. When you look at the names carved in the 187 men who died at the Alamo, what are their last names? Anybody? Yeah. So you've got Bowie, Crockett. You've also got Hernandez, Leguin. It's about two-thirds Hispanic, Tejano. Yet we often think of it as, oh, this is a movement of white supremacy. It's not it at all. Out of the 187, about a third of them were from Tennessee, and they were of Scotch-Irish descent. Two-thirds of them were all from Texas. They were Tejanos. They were Hispanic Texans. This was not a war against the Hispanics. This was a war absolutely in favor of a republic. And when they go to battle, look what Travis says here. It's amazing. And if any of you grew up in Texas, you have to memorize this. This is every public building has this letter posted. If you guys, any of you from Texas, it's everywhere. But think about what he says. This is incredible. I have sustained a continual bombardment of cannonade for 24 hours and not lost a man. Now, anybody know what their opposition was? They held out for 13 days, 187 guys, against 5,000 battle-hardened soldiers. 187 guys, 13 days, 4 separate assaults. On the fourth assault, they're all wiped out. All 187 of them are wiped out. But can you imagine? And how many did they kill? They killed 1,544 of the opposition. That's incredible. This is not a big military battle, 187 against 5,000. But it's no different than what we saw in Western Heritage with Leonidas in the 300 against 10,000. It's the same battle, just played out here in Texas. So this is where, Nicole, when you ask your question, I hope we realize this is not a moment of radical equality or imperialism. This is a moment of Republican sacrifice here, and they're very different. We'll pick that up more on Monday, but I want you to understand that there are a lot of threads going on here, not all the same cohesive narrative. There are different things. Manifest destiny is not republicanism. It's a perversion of it in some way. Okay, have a great weekend, everybody. Parents, I hope you guys enjoy your stay here, and we'll see you all on Monday. Yeah. Oh, yeah, your test. I'm sorry, guys. Yeah.